would triumph through suffering. America, Japan, and all other nations could be restored by helping Korea's anti-communist cause. Only in Korea could the civilizations of East and West be unified. In the end, Moon declares, even North Korea's Kim Il-sung could be restored if he answered the call to follow the divine principle. Details about Moon's early life. Now, note Moon's beginnings here before we proceed into this. Details about Moon's early life are not clear because of his efforts to tell the story himself only in terms of being the son of God. He was born in 1920 in North Korea. He was raised as a Presbyterian in a middle-class family and was a good student and studied engineering at a university in Japan during World War II. So Moon is in Japan during the Second World War. He was married in 1944 and divorced in 1950. He was arrested twice by the communist government in North Korea for activities as an evangelist and was sentenced to 5 years in prison in the fall of 1947. During the Korean War, when the United Nations forces reached Hung Nam Prison, he was released halfway through his sentence. He resumed his evangelical activities in Busan on the southeastern coast. With a small handful of followers in Seoul, he founded the Holy Spirit Association for the Unification of World Christianity, which became known as the Unification Church in 1954. So remember that Reverend Moon is in Japan during World War II, when, of course, the United States is fighting Japan. Recall also that Korea was a Japanese colony. It had originally been a Russian colony. However, after the Russo-Japanese War in 1905, Japan assumed stewardship over Korea, which she held until the end of the Second World War in 1945.
Couple of other points to be made very quickly. Also, for those who are familiar with the history of the time, they will be aware that that in Korea, the common view of Japan was not a very high one. As a matter of fact, the Japanese were absolutely hated in Korea because during the time of Japanese militarism, the Koreans were treated extremely badly by the Japanese occupying forces. In light of this, it's rather interesting that Sun Myung-moon should go off to Japan to study engineering at a university there during World War II and should come away with a view of Japan that it is part of the divine plan to help Korea, and in fact that for somebody who winds up in a fascist country that's oppressing his country, it's rather interesting that he winds up more on the side of the fascists than the communists. Okay, and of course, as noted before, the absolute and inescapable logic of Sun Myung-moon as far as the coming world, the cataclysm of which Korea will be the focus. Nonetheless, whether you're inclined to scoff at this sort of thing or not, this is a multi-million, probably now getting close to being a multi-billion-dollar operation worldwide, having a very profound effect on politics in many places right here on our own continent. And they are firmly convinced that it is going to come down to an Armageddon battle between communism and Christianity, of which they are going to be the leaders, so one would assume at least that they are doing their best to try and make sure that event happens.
Note also the tremendous egomania and the tremendous cult of personality that we have both with the Unification Church and with Jonestown. Notice how a single individual leader assumes total dominance over all aspects of cultural, intellectual, and political life of the cult. I mean, it's with Jonestown, you have Jim Jones, Jim Jones, Jim Jones, Jim Jones. With the Unification Church, you have Moon, 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 Moon. Remember that? And of course, in the context of all of these broadcasts on Radio Free America, we talk about fascism. Consider the totalitarian and fascistic aspects of these cults as we talk about them. So talking now about the fascistic dynamics within the cult society itself, not just their overt political views. And the overt political views are also obviously front and center, particularly with the Unification Church. And again, as we talk about the political history of the Unification Church, remember that Korea was a Japanese colony when the United States was fighting Imperial Japan during World War II.
Also, bear in mind a trend or a pattern that we've seen so many times, and that, of course, listeners to Radio Free America are going to be so aware of, which are the United States or the Allied powers moving in to liberate a country from fascism out of apparently total fear of communism, instead of actually allowing the people who, in many cases, Korea was fairly well subjugated, but in most other cases, the people actually fighting and organized to combat the fascist dominators of the country who are usually socialists or communists or at least progressive partisans. In many cases, they're actually just plain old, you know, middle of the road people who want their country back, are barred from office by the Allies as they move through. And in fact, we see reactionaries and in some cases people who actively supported the selfsame fascists being put back into power again. And of course, in Korea, because of the involvement of the Korean government, as we will see with the Unification Church, this is also an important factor and something to note, going along with gifts of deceit. Korea's liberation from Japan in 1945 was a tarnished triumph. The country was divided in half between a communist North and a non-communist South. Korea was again a pawn of the big powers, this time the Soviet Union and the United States. The Russians, accepting the surrender of Japanese forces north of the 38th parallel, set up a communist government there as they had done in East Germany. In the South, the American occupation authorities arrived knowing nothing about Korea. At first, they relied on the Japanese for help, and then later turned to Koreans who had collaborated with Japan. Korean Democrats were assumed to be too far to the left. To lead the new free South Korea, the Americans brought in Syngman Rhee, a reactionary politician who had spent the previous 35 years in the United States. Since Rhee had no power base of his own in Korea, Koreans formerly with the Japanese colonial administration formed the backbone of his regime. Funds to support him were given largely by those who had made money under the Japanese. Again, as mentioned before, a complete reestablishment of the Japanese colonial, basically fascist, militarist, whatever you want to call it, bureaucracy. In 1946, Park Chung-hee was admitted to South Korea's new military academy. We're going to be following Park and some of these other folks. One of the cadets entering in 1948 was Kim Jong-pil, who later married Park's niece. In 1961, he would help Park take over the country. He would also establish the Korean CIA, organize Park's political party, and see that the Park regime gave its blessing to the activities of Sun Myung-moon's Unification Church.
All right, so again, we can't emphasize too strongly that when the United States assumed the stewardship of Korea from Japan, whom it had defeated in the Second World War, basically the entire fascist Japanese colonial infrastructure was, at least for an interim period, returned to power in Korea to administer the takeover, the transition from Japanese to American rule. And many key Japanese fascists, if you will, or bureaucrats from the colonial Japanese administration, moved up into various aspects of the U.S. national security operations in the Pacific. And specifically, we're going to talk about a Japanese war criminal who became very, very influential with the Moonies and with the Lockheed Corporation, a lot of other things a little later in the broadcast. But what we're talking about here, folks, is the people we were fighting in World War II, again, this over in the Pacific theater now, become agents of American policy after the war. The very people who bombed Pearl Harbor are then the recipients of large amounts of American capital, and also they become the proteges of the United States and administer American policy in the Pacific. And that is the bottom line with the Unification Church, are the very people who we fought against in World War II, just as the Galen Organization was brought in at the end of World War II. The Unification Church involves Japanese fascists, the folks who bombed Pearl Harbor. So that's really the bottom line here, what we're talking about with the Unification Church. Now, some of the key people in the Moonies, in the Unification Church, are very close to the Korean CIA. Now, the Korean CIA is very, very close to the American CIA, works hand in glove with it. And it's worth noting here the presence of the Korean CIA agents in very, very influential positions in the Unification Church. Also worth noting how these agents' presence in the Unification Church results in the elevation of the Unification Church to essentially nothing more or less than an official wing or an official organ of South Korean policy. Again, going back to Gifts of Deceit by Robert Beecher. Speaking of Moon, four of his early followers were young army officers close to Kim Jong-pil, the chief planner for the Park regime and founding director of the KCIA. Kim Song-in, his last name is like Sang-in, S-A-N-G-I-N, also called Steve Kim, K-I-M, his interpreter, later to become KCIA station chief in Mexico City, Han Sang-kuk, S-A-N-G-K-E-U-K, K-E-U-K, Bud Han, who became ambassador to Norway, Han Song-kil, K-I-L, who became Moon's personal secretary after serving at the Korean embassy in Washington, and Bo-hee Pak, Moon's advance man in Washington during and after Park's service as assistant military attaché at the Korean embassy. So Kim Jong-pil is not only head of the Korean CIA, but is sort of like the right-hand man and chief executor of Park Chung-hee's policy in Korea. He becomes a key Moony protege, so basically protector, I should say, and he founds the KCIA. A top KCIA official, Bo-hee Pak, as well as these other fellows, Kim Song-in, Han Sang-kuk, and Han Sang-kil, become key Moony officials, continuing with Gifts of Deceit. Kim Jong-pil made a two-week official visit to the United States as KCIA director in the fall of 1962. Included in his entourage was Steve Kim as interpreter. The Korean embassy mobilized for the occasion, and the Kennedy administration rolled out the red carpet. Lieutenant Colonel Bo-hee Pak was the embassy's officer in charge for Kim's meetings with CIA Director John McCone, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, and Defense Intelligence Agency head Lieutenant General J.E. Carroll. En route home, Kim Jong-pil met secretly in his room at the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco with a small group of Moon's early activists, who had been sent to proselytize on the West Coast and some American converts. Kim Young-oon, Y-O-U-N-G-O-O-N, beginning in Eugene, Oregon in 1959, had moved to Berkeley, California. Choi Sang-ik, S-A-N-G-I-K, having established the church in Japan, had moved to San Francisco. Kim told them he sympathized with Moon's goals and promised to help the Unification Church with political support from inside the government. He said he could not afford to do so openly, however, which fit Moon's plans perfectly. Kim Jong-pil had learned from Moon's followers in the KCIA that Moon was a zealous anti-communist. Interrupting the narrative here, recall Kim Jong-pil is South Korean President Park Chung-hee's right-hand man, both Kim Jong-pil and Park Chung-hee having been Japanese military cadets when Japan was at war with the U.S. Kim Jong-pil had learned from Moon's followers in the KCIA that Moon was a zealous anti-communist. That could be useful to the government. He was also aware of Moon's ambition to build influence in Korea and beyond. That could create problems for the government if the influence were not properly channeled. Moon was anxious to increase church membership in cities and villages throughout the country. Fine, thought Kim, just as long as they don't get out of bounds. The KCIA must be the one calling the shots. He decided the Unification Church should be organized satisfactorily to be utilized as a political tool whenever he and the KCIA needed it. Organizing and utilizing the Unification Church would be a simple matter anyhow. After the military coup overthrew the elected government in 1961, all organizations in Korea were required to apply for re-registration with the government. Undesirable elements were identified through a process of re-evaluation and dealt with accordingly. Kim could maintain effective ties with Moon's organization through the four army officers, but the Moonies had best not be told of Kim's plans to manipulate them. It was a situation favorable both to Moon's plans for expanding via the good graces of the government and to Kim Jong-pil's plans for building a personal power base. Before Nip-Tok continues reading here, so remember, the key link-ups between the Moony leadership and the Korean CIA and the eventual decision by Kim Jong-pil, right-hand man for the South Korean president, to, in essence, co-opt the Unification Church and to turn it into nothing more or less than an organ of the Korean CIA. So that's what we're talking about here. And recall, again, the South Korean national security establishment's antecedents with imperial fascist Japan.
Okay, continuing with Gifts of Deceit. Bo-hee Pak's work for Moon in America was of crucial importance. Pak is a model Moony. For him, master always comes first. From the time he joined Moon in 1957, he endeavored to make everything he did contribute in some way to Moon's divine mission. Assignment to the embassy in Washington in 1961 was a precious opportunity to do missionary work in the United States. As a diplomat, he could foster Moon's interest within the ROK government, that's the Korean government, and keep Moon apprised of important intelligence. It was God's providence that he go to America, he believed, and he must make the most of it. Pak witnessed tirelessly for Moon. Every new acquaintance was a potential convert. His home on North Utah Street in Arlington, Virginia, was a recruiting center. Every social gathering there was a potential study group. He was assisted in his ministry by his wife and another Mooney living with him, Jun Ri, who later became well known as the owner of a chain of Korean karate schools. In 1963, Pak established the Unification Church in Virginia. The incorporation papers declared the church to be totally independent from any other organization and affiliated with the original movement in Korea only on a doctrinal basis. Airline pilot Robert Rowland and his wife were cultivated patiently by Pak over a period of several months without a hint about the connection with Moon. The Rowlands and the Paks became close friends. On one occasion, Rowland asked what the duties of an assistant military attaché were. Pak was candid about his intelligence role at the embassy. He explained that in addition to routine diplomatic work, he was responsible for liaison between South Korean and American intelligence agencies, which often required his visiting the super-secret National Security Agency, NSA, located at Fort Meade, Maryland. Rowland asked about the work the NSA did. Pak volunteered that it dealt mainly with secret codes and monitoring of radio transmissions. Rowland, a bit startled by the information, was finding his new friend to be an intriguing person.
So, as we begin to develop the history of the Unification Church, note all of the powerful interests and organizations and people that connect up with the Unification Church, that do its bidding in one capacity or another, or allow their names to be used in order to lend prestige to the American activities of the Unification Church. Here we have Bo Hee Pak, the fellow who runs the Mooney news organizations, hooking up with the National Security Agency. Recall that the KCIA, of which the Unification Church is essentially an organ, is very close to and works very closely with the American CIA. A key organization to understand in dealing with the Moonies is something called the KCFF, the Korean Cultural and Freedom Foundation. This also is a Bo Hee Pak creation, and the KCFF, the Korean Cultural and Freedom Foundation, has some very interesting names connected with it, and we're going to talk about those in just a second. Going back to Gifts of Deceit by Robert Beecher. Pak hit upon the idea of an American-based foundation to sponsor not only the Little Angels, interrupting, that's a group of girl singers, of children singers for the Moonies. Pak hit upon the idea of an American-based foundation to sponsor not only the Little Angels, but other Moon projects as well. The foundation should have broad-based appeal, so it could not be identified openly with the Unification Church. Promoting people-to-people relations with Korea and opposing communism seemed lucrative themes. Americans would contribute money to those causes, especially if recommended by distinguished leaders. Unknowingly, they would be serving Moon, but in the long run, they would be rewarded by Moon's establishing the Kingdom of Heaven on Earth. Thus was born the Korean Cultural and Freedom Foundation, the KCFF, in 1964. Unlike some other front groups, the KCFF acknowledged no affiliation with Moon. Bo Hee Pak would pretend his practice of Moon's religion and his work for KCFF were unrelated. Moon's founding of the Little Angels would be downplayed so that Pak and the KCFF could get the maximum advantage of appearing independently successful. However, KCFF money would be used to help make the Unification Church strong in America. The foundation would require more of Pak's time than was allowed by moonlighting. He could no longer afford to waste his workdays at the embassy. His position there had opened the right doors in Washington, but had outlived its usefulness. The moment it arrived to start working full-time for Master, Master, of course, is Moon. With the church's government connections in Seoul, he arranged for early retirement from the Army. Although now a private citizen, he was able to return to the United States on a diplomatic visa backed by a letter from the Ministry of National Defense saying he was performing an unspecified special diplomatic mission. The key to successful fundraising and propaganda was endorsement by influential people. It was essential, therefore, to have the right names in the top positions, although Pak would see to it that he alone ran the foundation. He found a useful figurehead in the person of Yang Yuchan, Y-O-U-C-H-N, Republic of Korea Ambassador to the United States during the Korean War. Retired and settled in Washington, Yang was known and respected by American government leaders from the 50s and still carried the title of Ambassador at Large. He was especially noted for his staunch anti-communism. Yang agreed to be executive vice president and persuaded retired Admiral Arleigh Burke to accept the presidency. Bo Hee Pak was vice president. Burke and Yang gathered an impressive list of names for the KCFF letterhead. Former Presidents Truman and Eisenhower as honorary presidents. Kim Jong-pil as honorary chairman. The directors and advisors included Richard Nixon, George Meany, Pearl Mesta, Senator Hugh Scott, Senator Homer Capehart, General Matthew Ridgway, and Congressman Clement Zablocki. So here we have three former U.S. presidents lending their names to basically a Mooney front and lending their prestige to Moon's fundraising activities. And recall again the Japanese fascist origins of the Moonies. So here the KCFF, a very important Moon organization, and we're going to see a lot of very powerful interests and people connected to the Moonies and their activities worldwide.
Now, Gifts of Deceit goes on, among other things, to explain some of the other things that the KCFF and the Moonies got involved in, among them an early predecessor of the newspaper that they're involved with now. The predecessor was called the News World, published in New York, and masked as a non-Mooney project, but actually staffed by Moonies on the editorial staff and definitely focused against Mooney enemies, accusing congressmen of being Soviet agents, things of that nature. Anyway, going on with Gifts of Deceit, besides newspapers, Moon's media business included movies. He told the cult in 1974 he was forming a movie company in Japan. He was looking for the right script for a film on the life of Jesus, but was open to other subjects also. He could produce films to serve his unified three-pronged purpose: religious propaganda, political propaganda, and business profit. Mitsuharo Ishii, a Japanese Mooney, became president of One Way Production, with offices in Tokyo and Los Angeles. One Way's main project was to make an anti-communist war spectacle on General MacArthur's landing at Incheon in the Korean War. Money and actors were to come from Korea, Japan, and the United States. At Times Square in July 1979, New Yorkers were treated to neon lights advertising The News World, that's the newspaper previously mentioned, and a movie being filmed in Korea, Incheon, starring Laurence Olivier, Jacqueline Bisset, Ben Gazzara, David Janssen, and Toshiro Mifune. Moon's drive to dominate the American fishing industry was perhaps his most ambitious business undertaking. International Oceanic Enterprises was incorporated in Virginia in November 1976, along with a subsidiary, International Seafood Corporation, located in Norfolk. Bo Hee Pak was president. The company engaged in operating fishing boats and processing and selling seafood products. With the Unification Church International pumping millions into the business, International Seafood was able, within a few weeks of its incorporation, to disperse monies to the other components of the Moon organization, including $200,000 to Tong Eel Enterprises and $400,000 to U.S. Marine Corporation for buying 700 acres of waterfront property in Bayou-Labatre, Alabama. U.S. Marine Corporation was yet another Mooney concern. Its shipbuilding affiliate was appropriately named A. Master Marine. In Richmond, Virginia, housewives could buy fresh seafood at a store named Father's Fish. Moon's fishing and seafood tentacles spread to San Francisco, Gloucester, Massachusetts. I don't know if that's how they pronounce it in Massachusetts. In England, it's Gloucester. And Kodiak, Alaska. He had a built-in competitive advantage, abundant capital flow from church sources, and negligible labor costs using cult manpower. He envisioned a food crisis in the future when the world would come begging to him.
So take a look at Moon's activities here. We have him not only running newspapers, but becoming a very, very successful and large-scale business entrepreneur, becoming one of the major factors in the American fishing industry. Okay? Not only is Moon involved with fish, but also with guns as well, specifically the M16, the standard shoulder arm of the American and South Korean armies, continuing with Gifts of Deceit. Making and selling M16 rifles made sense both economically and politically. In public, Moon and the cult denied being involved with the M16, the basic infantry weapon of the South Korean Army. Moon conceded to Newsweek magazine that Tong Il Industries produced armaments for the Korean government, but would not say which weapons, claiming the information was classified by his government. However, information from the U.S. State Department and American and Korean businessmen in the arms field shows that Tong Il Industries, that's T-O-N-G, second word is I-L, Tong Il Industries makes parts for the Vulcan anti-aircraft gun, the M-79 grenade launcher, the M-60 machine gun, and the M-16 rifle. One American businessman was shown the machinery used to make the weapons during a tour of Tong Il's plant near Busan. H.P. Stone, vice president of Colt Industries of Hartford, Connecticut, learned how close the operational ties are between Moon and the Park regime. His experience left the impression that with respect to the M-16 rifle, the Moon organization and the Korean government were one and the same. Colt holds the patent for the M-16 and has a co-production agreement with the Republic of Korea government approved by the American government. The agreement allows the Republic of Korea Ministry of National Defense to make the rifle in Korea for the ROK Army. Stone got a letter from Tong Il Industries in September of 1977 asking for approval for Tong Il to produce the M-16 for export. Stone answered in the negative, saying his company did not have authority to approve and he was certain the U.S. government would be against the Koreans exporting the rifles. In October, Stone cabled the Ministry of National Defense on another matter. Since the U.S. State Department had approved Korea's request to make another 300,000 M-16s, Stone offered the ministry a new extended contract. For several weeks, there was no reply. Then, to his surprise, an answer came not from the Korean government, but from Tong Il Industries. Tong Il said it would send representatives to Hartford in December to discuss the extension of the M-16 production contract. The discussions took place as scheduled, with the president of Tong Il, Moon Sung Kyun, Master's cousin, negotiating for a contract between the Republic of Korea government and Colt Industries. When Stone asked if Tong Il was formally representing the Korean government, Moon Sung Kyun smiled and said, quote, "If you ask the Ministry of National Defense, they will say no." So basically, Moon produces the M-16s for the South Korean government, was seeking lines for seeking permission for exporting these rifles abroad. Again, an interesting fellow, an interesting series of activities for a fellow whose roots go back to fascist Japan to be doing. And again, this not only in conjunction with, but perhaps to at least to a considerable extent at the behest of and on behalf of the U.S. government. And we're going to see many, many more activities and many more powerful and influential organizations and people hooked up with this organization.
Okay, Gifts of Deceit goes on to describe some of the activities on the part of certain members of Congress trying to get some contacts, trying to get some information out of the about the Moonies and some of their involvement, including Congressman Fraser's attempt to subpoena Sun Myung Moon to appear and answer questions in front of a congressional committee. Sun Myung Moon skips the country in May of 1978, skips out of the United States to London. Going on with the book, it says Fraser was not the only one closing in on the Moonies. The Korean Cultural and Freedom Foundation had been barred from soliciting contributions in New York after 1976. The State Social Welfare Board had discovered that less than 7% of the funds collected by KCFF for the Children's Relief Fund could have been used for that purpose. The public was told that the money was urgently needed to save the lives of 350,000 children who were facing, quote, terminal forms of malnutrition in Southeast Asia. Contributions were to be used to buy emergency supplies of blood, plasma, and food. The Children's Relief Fund appears to have been more an exercise in image building than a drive to raise funds for the cult's coffers. An audit showed that Bohee Pak himself got $26,000 each year, while the bulk of contributions, in 1975, $920,000, was paid to the Richard A. Viguerie Company, a professional fundraising firm for handling the mail solicitations. We'll get back to that in a moment. Another $58,000 went to the Associated Public Relations Council of Washington, owned by Donald Miller, who was also the executive director of KCFF. Richard Viguerie, of course, for those of you who are not familiar, is known as the direct mail wizard. He is the man who basically has been spearheading the conservative political action committees in this country since 1980, a man of extremely right-wing views himself, a man who thinks that Ronald Reagan has been pulled to the left and needs to be brought back to the right again. And Mr. Viguerie has turned up in a number of these areas, including, I think, the other day when Ed Meese was up for his first nomination as Attorney General. Richard Viguerie suggested that Howard Metzenbaum of Ohio, who was asking a lot of questions about about Ed Meese's background and his fitness as the potential attorney general. Richard Viguerie suggested that Howard Metzenbaum was a Stalinist. So Viguerie, as you can see, is no blushing violet of a leftist himself, and that's where a lot of the money went from the this particular KCFF project.
Now notice that the KCFF, the Korean Cultural and Freedom Foundation, on whose behalf former Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Nixon were willing to work, here winds up channeling money originally destined for relief for Southeast Asian refugee children, and it winds up going to one of the leading stars on the horizon of the far right. Okay, Richard Viguerie, one of the top people among the political action committees of the far right. And it's worth noting the connections between the Unification Church and the Nixon presidency here, because we're going to take a look at the intersection between the Nixon presidency and the Moonies, and specifically the Moonies' involvement with the Watergate scandal and with some of the people and elements coming out of the Watergate scandal, returning to Gifts of Deceit. As Moon saw it, he was organizing and utilizing the Republic of Korea government, not the other way around. The government officials indoctrinated at his school would be led to the divine principle by way of anti-communism. Building military hardware under government contract would make the government dependent on him while providing funds for him to expand worldwide. The government was indebted to him for the cultural propaganda he had generated through his Little Angels. Recall, that's that Moon singing group. If he could save Nixon, save Nixon during the Watergate crisis, if he could save Nixon, his power would overshadow Park Chung-hee, and ruling the Atom Country would be only a step away. He could assume his rightful position. He reminded the cult that what he was doing in Project Watergate was far more significant for its impact in Korea than in the United States. On Capitol Hill, Project Watergate brought some early results. In January of 1974, a two-day lobbying blitz for signatures on Moon's Watergate declaration yielded about 100 congressmen and some 10 senators. The lobbyists concealed their affiliation with the Unification Church from legislators. Several months later, anti-impeachment leader Rabbi Korff, K-O-R-F-F, and Nixon aide Bruce Hershenson appealed for another Mooney display of mass support for Nixon. They valued Moon's help because he could mobilize large numbers of people anywhere on short notice and with good results. Moon was cool to the request. He said no. Korff and Hershenson asked again and again, but Moon kept turning them down. The Lord of the Second Advent wanted homage from the president. Nixon should repent to Moon for his failure of leadership, then Moon would rally the troops. Salonen was caught awkwardly in the middle. He had no decision-making power. All he could do was transmit messages back and forth between the White House and Moon's Korean-Japanese Adam-Eve hierarchy. Korff and Hershenson offered no possibility of Nixon's kneeling before Moon. Ultimately, Moon decided to hold a three-day fast on the Capitol steps, independent of White House appeals, he insisted. It was July of 1974. Things were grim for Nixon. It was time for a miracle. If anyone could deliver, Moon said, it was he. Chris Elkins helped staff the fast on the Capitol steps. Placards and posters were designed. Literature was prepared and distributed. A press corps was set up. They hoped to get Nixon to address the fasters in person. 600 Moonies were shipped to Washington to do the fasting and praying. That number was chosen so as to have each Mooney pray for one senator, congressman, and cabinet member, with Salonen and his wife taking President and Mrs. Nixon. They prayed for releasing God's power to turn the heart of America toward forgiveness for Nixon. Nixon did not appear. He sent a telegram instead. At the end of the third day, Moon came accompanied by Rabbi Korff. He addressed the fasters, telling them they had completed their mission successfully. It was the only time Chris Elkins ever heard Father bestowing full approval on his followers. So the Moonies are lobbying on behalf of Richard Nixon during the last stages of Watergate. Apparently, according to Mr. Beecher, the main goal was not even to save Richard Nixon, but in order to save Richard Nixon as a vehicle for prestige for Reverend Moon so that he could become the head of state of the Republic of Korea. Okay, but keep in mind the involvement with Richard Nixon, with the Korean Cultural and Freedom Foundation, and that organization's involvement with Richard Viguerie. Keep in mind the involvement of the Moonies with Watergate, because a number of different people and elements from the Watergate scandal are going to crop up later in connection with the Moonies. Worth noting, too, we're not going to get into the real meat of the Koreagate scandal here. It's a complex scandal. Suffice it to say that it grew out of Richard Nixon's so-called Guam Doctrine, which in the early years of the Nixon presidency called for the United States to build up anti-communist governments around the world and allow them to sort of fight in place of American troops. Recall that the U.S. was at that point winding out of Vietnam. Using the Guam Doctrine, the Unification Church and Korea, the Korean government, were able to make considerable inroads in the United States and gain approval of the federal government. And in order to influence the American government in such a way as to pass legislation and generally make rulings favorable to the commercial and military interests of the Republic of Korea, of South Korea, a huge lobbying organization was set up. The two main prongs of this were the Unification Church proper and a Korean businessman named Tong Jin Park, who was very closely affiliated with the Moonies, and he was sort of the other main prong of the Korean lobbying interest in this country, seeking to turn American policy in such a way as to further Nixon's Guam Doctrine vis-a-vis Korea. And some of the key names to take note, it was Speaker of the House Carl Albert was one of the people who was compromised by the Moonies and sort of wound up in Moon's camp. This is significant for our purposes, that this is covered at length in Gifts of Deceit. Significant for our purposes because Carl Albert is in the line of presidential succession, and that could have played a very important part had the impeachment proceedings in Watergate proceeded.
Yes, especially since Spiro Agnew had just been forced out, too, at that time. Okay, back to the subject of the ongoing investigation of Congressman Fraser into the Moonies and into the labyrinth of the Unification Church. Just a short section here to show some more interesting folks the Moonies got hooked up with. Again, they're talking about Fraser. Congressman Fraser this time is battling an absolute blizzard of slanderous attacks from the Moonies because he was pursuing their organization. Basically, the Moonies bringing in all of their friends and everybody that they had contact with, slandering Fraser's wife and family and people like that. Also, though, they were combating this on a legal level, too. Reading, again, from Gifts of Deceit, a short paragraph. To assert Master's position authoritatively, the Moon Organization hired outstanding legal talent. Moon's own attorney was Charles Stillman of New York. Bohee Pak retained John Bray and Frank Lilly of one of Washington's largest firms, Arendt, Fox, Kintner, Plotkin, and Kahn. The Unification Church was represented by the firm of Melrod, Redman, and Gartland. Former Watergate prosecutor Richard Benveniste, along with Michael Golden, handled most of Melrod, Redman, and Gartland's work for the church. Okay, Richard Benveniste, of course, is a name most of you are familiar with, at least those of you who are old enough to have been around to watch the Watergate proceedings when they were on the air.
Okay, now, the fact that Richard Benveniste, an assistant Watergate prosecutor, was among the attorneys representing elements of the Unification Church, who were the defendants in the Koreagate scandal, is worth noting here, because a fellow we've talked about a great deal in the past was selected as the special counsel to the Koreagate, to the House Ethics Committee and Senate, the Ethics Committees investigating the influence buying on behalf of the Republic of Korea. Now, that fellow who was appointed special counsel for Koreagate was none other than Leon Jaworski. Now, Leon Jaworski, of course, was a person we've looked at in the past. First of all, we've taken a look at him in connection with the Warren Commission's investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, Leon Jaworski was a special counsel to the Warren Commission. He was also special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry, which investigated the Kennedy assassination, or allegedly investigated the Kennedy assassination on behalf of the state of Texas. And specifically, Jaworski's role for the Warren Commission was investigating whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald had any intelligence connections. And the evidence that he did is massive. And
however, that is, it should be mentioned that that is not the evidence that Leon Jaworski came out with.
That was exactly it. Leon Jaworski said, nothing here, and that is at the, to say the least, highly suspect, since there are massive indications that Oswald had many connections with several, profound connections with several U.S. intelligence agencies, including the FBI, the CIA, and Naval Intelligence. Okay, Leon Jaworski found none of those intelligence connections, and possibly the reason for that was that Leon Jaworski himself had a very definite intelligence connection, or at least one definite connection that's come to light so far. Leon Jaworski was head of an organization, and recall that we looked at all of this information in our Guns of November program, and again, those broadcasts, like the Radio Free America broadcasts, are available for somebody if you'd like to if you missed those and you'd like to catch up on those, give us a call after the program. We'll tell you how you can pick them up. But in our Guns of November broadcast about the assassination of President Kennedy, we took a look at the fact that Leon Jaworski, now a member of the Warren Commission, Watergate special prosecutor and special counsel for the investigation of Koreagate, Leon Jaworski was head of an organization called the M.D. Anderson Fund. The M.D. Anderson Fund was identified as a CIA domestic funding conduit. So therefore, it's highly suspect or highly questionable whether Leon Jaworski should have even been allowed to serve on either the Warren Commission or as Watergate special prosecutor. Now recall, When Jaworski was selected to replace Archibald Cox as Watergate prosecutor in the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, in which Archibald Cox and several Justice Department officials left. Basically, Cox was fired. Several Justice Department officials refused to fire Archibald Cox, and they resigned instead. So that's where the name Saturday Night Massacre came from. Leon Jaworski then replaces Cox as Watergate special prosecutor, and among the many people that we looked at who figure both in the Kennedy assassination and in Watergate was none other than Richard Nixon himself, who was in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963. When interviewed by the FBI 2 months later, he lied about it. At least we have to assume it was a lie. He, for some reason, was unable to remember that he was in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963. In fact, within 2 months, Richard Nixon's memory was off by a full 48 hours. He told the FBI that he left on November 20th, 1963. Now recall, of course, that Nixon ran against President Kennedy in 1960, was defeated by him. And one of the things they say about the Kennedy assassination is that everyone remembers where they were when they heard that Kennedy was assassinated. Well, Richard Nixon, apparently, within 2 months, his memory was off by a full 48 hours, if we are to presume innocence on his part. And recall the interesting connections of Watergate special prosecutor and former Warren Commission counsel Leon Jaworski. He then jumps to be Koreagate special prosecutor. Recall the profound connections between the American intelligence establishment and the Moonies. And recall that one of the defense attorneys working on behalf of the Moonies was none other than former Watergate prosecutor Richard Benveniste, who worked with Leon Jaworski. It's quite a mouthful, quite a few things to remember, but it's worth tying all of these things up so that we start getting some of the feeling for the various themes which run through the various broadcasts that we're talking about and the information which is now beginning to sort of pile up in these Radio Free America broadcasts.
You still have to read this section, too.
Oh, well, my God. that's really going to be quite a task here, okay? So we're going to get my mouth dried out, and okay, here we go. Get our equipment all stashed away here. I'd forgotten all about it. I'm glad you reminded me. Anyway, remember all of the stuff after that, this little interlude. Remember Leon Jaworski, remember Nixon, remember the unifications connections to both, recall the connections of both Nixon and Jaworski to the assassination of President Kennedy. And before we get into another aspect of the Unification Church, it might be worth mentioning also that in another Radio Free America broadcast in which we dealt with Messrs. Wilson and Turpel, the quote X unquote CIA agents, it was mentioned by Frank Turpel that Edwin Wilson had connections with Tongs and Park and that they had in fact worked quite closely together. That information is corroborated, by the way, in a current book which has some information about Watergate called Secret Agenda by a man named Jim Hogan, whose book Spooks we're going to touch on in just a second. Now, another organization which figures both in connection with the Moonies and in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy is something called the World Anti-Communist League. And the World Anti-Communist League is currently chaired by a fellow by the name of John Singlaub, an American general, a former general of ultra-right-wing persuasion. And two names that we're going to be looking at in connection with the Unification Church are a couple of former Japanese war criminals named Roichi Sasakawa and Yoshio Kadama, both men mentioned in Gifts of Deceit as follows. In 1969, Moon decided it was time to get his rank and file in America busy combating communism. He had been waging extensive anti-communist campaigns in Korea and Japan under the aegis of his International Federation for the Extermination of Communism, with political and financial support from Roichi Sasakawa, R-O-R-Y-O-I-C-H-I-S-A-S-A-K-A-W-A, and Yoshio Kadama, Y-O-S-H-I-O-K-O-D-A-M-A. Beginning that sentence again. He had been waging extensive anti-communist campaigns in Korea and Japan under the aegis of his International Federation for the Extermination of Communism, with political and financial support from Roichi Sasakawa and Yoshio Kodama and other powerful Japanese right-wing figures. He organized the Freedom League, the Freedom Leadership Foundation, the FLF, the American branch of his International Federation. Its president, Alan Tate Wood, mobilized Muni groups throughout the country to lobby for the hawk position in Vietnam and to try and defuse the peace movement. Wood and eight other American Muni leaders attended the annual conference of the World Anti-Communist League in Kyoto, Japan in September of 1970. The conference was the biggest ever held by the World League, largely because the sponsoring organization that year was a Moon group, Shokyo Rengo, S-H-O-K-Y-O-R-E-N-G-O, the Japanese branch of his International Anti-Communist Federation. Master ordered the Japanese Moonies to prepare for the event with a massive fundraising drive, which reportedly yielded $1.4 million brought in by selling flowers in the streets. Through the KCFF, the Moon organization was able to engage Senator Strom Thurmond as guest speaker. Of course, Strom Thurmond, very much on the scene today, and another, I couldn't call him a figure on the new right, but one of the linchpins of the old right who has lingered to this day. Now, before we proceed here with these two Japanese war criminals, again, very much affiliated with the Moonies, let's review the connection of the World Anti-Communist League to the assassination of President Kennedy.
One of the most interesting events in the story of the assassination of John F. Kennedy was, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald's visit to Russia. This has been talked about a great deal, and yet quite a few of the details of the visit itself and Lee Harvey Oswald's return are not talked about quite so much. One of the things that is not mentioned is, again, the entire Warren Commission thesis is based on the fact that it's largely hung on the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald is some kind of a disaffected leftist. Well, there are numerous accounts of Lee Harvey Oswald's right-wing connections of various sorts and types. One of the interesting examples is that the only person, Lee Harvey Oswald was at the Atsugi Naval Air Base in Japan, defected to Russia, supposedly taking with him secrets that he threatened to give to the Russians about America's most important defense systems. Yet after Lee Harvey Oswald had spent quite some time in Russia and came back, the only people who met him, there was no official deprogramming of Lee Harvey